Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Blue Economy Podcast. I'm your host, Admiral Tim Gallaudet, CEO of Ocean STL Consulting, former Deputy Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. I was also an Assistant Secretary of Commerce, and before that, the Oceanographer of the Navy. We're a monthly offering by the American Shoreline Podcast Network and brought to you by Coastal News Today. The American Blue Economy Podcast brings together leading voices in the ocean and coastal and Great Lakes-based economies to expand awareness and collaboration, identify positive solutions to address the many challenges to the ocean economy, such as conflicting uses and climate change, and provide thought leadership on keeping the blue economy at the forefront of American conservation and prosperity. Today's episode is going to be really interesting. We're going to go into a deep dive about a new initiative by World Wildlife Fund. WWF, people know the organization very well, and we are going to examine their Ocean Futures platform, an innovative effort to predict and prevent conflict over illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing, often called IUU fishing. I don't think many Americans know this, but fish is a conflict commodity. From community-level disagreements about the borders of fishing grounds to the use of force between international navies and industrial fishing fleets, conflict over fisheries threatens food security, contributes to social upheaval, escalates geopolitical tensions, and can short-circuit the success of conservation efforts. And then when you add to that climate change impacts, which is, these are only escalating the risks as fish move within and across international borders in search of more habitable waters. So the Oceans Futures platform is going to integrate existing climate and fisheries models with emerging science and data on the causes of fisheries conflict to predict, which is really powerful, the location of future conflict hotspots. And the users will be people in the national security, seafood, conservation sectors, and many others. So it's just really exciting way of applying big data and advanced analytics to a really important global security issue. But before I begin, I'd like our listeners to know that our media team at Coastal News Today is looking for sponsors. And if you are interested in becoming a sponsor, please contact Tyler Buckingham at tyler@coastalnewstoday.com or go to coastalnewstoday.com/advertising. And my guest today is an expert in this topic. She's published about fisheries conflicts. She's the senior director at World Wildlife Fund, Dr. Sarah Glasser. Sarah, it's so good to have you on.
Thank you, Tim. It's great to be here with you.
Right on. Well, I'm excited to introduce you because we have so much in common, and one being our common degrees at Scripps Institution. But just tell us a bit about yourself before we get into the topic here. Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Kansas, small town called Emporia, Kansas, over on the eastern side. So I grew up on the Great Plains and spent my undergraduate years at Kansas State University working on the Konza Prairie, which has its own herd of bison, where they study the impacts of bison grazing on grassland prairies. So that is what informed my early days as a field biologist.
That's interesting. Oh, so you kind of fell in love with nature and animals through your life out there and your observations?
Yeah, well, and even much longer, you know, much younger than being in college. But that was my first opportunity to really be a scientist. And so I have to say that most of my life, I wanted to be a marine biologist, and I was stuck in Kansas. And I shouldn't say stuck because it's a really great part of the country and has some of the best sunsets around. But I was in Kansas wanting to be a marine biologist because when I was pretty young, I'd guess about 7 or 8, my grandparents gave me a coffee table book by Jacques Cousteau about the ocean. And it had this beautiful picture of a clownfish and an anemone on the front. It was called The Ocean. And I just devoured that book and the photography and wanted to be a wildlife photographer and work for National Geographic and spend my days scuba diving on coral reefs. So that kind of brought me into the world of marine biology.
Right. I had that book as well. I have that book with the clownfish on it. I know the book. It's a big coffee table book like you described.
Yep.
And it's just stunning, all the footage in there. And I fell in love with the ocean too, having that in our house. And I've had several episodes where people have shared that Jacques Cousteau was their main influence. So I think we all have that in common. Wonderful. And then after Kansas State University, where'd you go?
Well, I spent, while I was at Kansas State, I got to dip my toes into the ocean at the School for Field Studies, which was a summer program. They also have semester-long programs in the Turks and Caicos Islands. So ooh. I wasn't certified to scuba dive yet, but I did get to do a lot of snorkeling on the reefs around the Turks and Caicos, around the island of South Caicos. And the project they had us working on there, that was back in 1997, was community engagement to improve the enforcement of the boundaries of a marine protected area. It was to prevent over-harvesting of lobster and conch and illegal incursions. I mean, little did I know at the time how influential that kind of work would be on my career later, because I eventually got pretty far away from coral reef ecology. But I spent some time there, loved the School for Field Studies. They've got active programs around the world. And then I went to James Cook University in Australia, in Townsville, Australia, and got to spend the last year of my undergraduate career doing only marine biology classes and learning from some of the greats about coral reef biology and fisheries ecology and spending time at some of the islands out there and finally getting scuba certified. And that was fun. That was a really great experience. Wow. And then I went to Scripps. So that kind of brings us up to 2002.
Right. How neat. I come across a lot of people, more than I would have thought, that have had a time at James Cook University in Australia. I guess our field attracts that, and that's wonderful. But Scripps as well, and I love that we share the fact we both have degrees from there, PhDs, and you did fisheries ecology, I did underwater acoustics, but we overlapped. So you got there, yeah, we did overlap. No, you were there from 2002, is that right?
I started in August of 2002. Classes started for me.
Oh, I just missed seeing you then. Okay. I got my degree in 2001, right after 9/11, and flew to a ship out off Afghanistan and flying strikes into there during freedom. So we just missed. That's, wow. But we were around the same time and saw a lot of the same people. But you were there from, when did you get your degree?
2009, February 2009. So unlike you, I departed from my dissertation defense and did not go off to fight for our country. I went off and got married instead.
Oh, well, very important, actually, as important. So did you take some time in between when you got married? Or did you do six and a half years or so?
No, I did 6.5 years at Scripps. I went straight from my undergraduate and spent a couple years doing coursework and figuring out what my thesis was going to be about and defended that, you know, a couple years in. And then I spent a lot of time in the field. I worked on commercial and recreational tuna fishing boats out in the Pacific Ocean. And
oh, gosh.
I get very seasick.
Oh, no.
I knew that a little bit ahead of time, but I'll tell you, my mettle was really tested on Scripps' large research vessel, the Revel, which you are probably familiar with.
Oh, yeah, I've done it.
Yep, and I was working on a project as a first-year grad student. And you're pretty low on the pole when you're a first-year grad student, right? So I was there for my own research project on the impact of temperature development. Sorry, the impact of temperature on the development of fish eggs, specifically anchovies and sardines. And this was relevant to what I wanted to understand predator-prey relationships. And I was really interested in sardine and anchovy and what made them different, because they look the same. And if you buy them in a can, they taste the same, which is not good, in my opinion. I'm going to get in trouble for saying that. You know, lots of people love sardines and anchovies, but I spent enough time dissecting them that I can't eat them anymore. But anyway, they develop at different rates. And so they have slightly different temperature tolerances as well. But more important than that, they eat different things in the water column. And so there's a big split between these fish that look the same, act the same, school the same. You know, they're very similar. Anyway, I spent a lot of time looking at a microscope in one of the labs on that ship. And so I spent about 10 days just sick as a dog on that
oh,
vessel.
My gosh. Yeah, trying to do work like that on a vessel at sea and be seasick, I can't imagine. But there's a good point to this discussion, because I have gained an appreciation for what it takes to get a PhD, certainly in a marine biology field. And it's a lot of work, 6.5 years, as you described, going to sea. And I know the process for me. It's you really do learn, you learn how to learn. And so I have great respect. And there could be nobody person that WWF could have picked to do, lead this project, because you're, everything you've done has led up to you doing it. So I'm very just excited that they made the right choice.
Well, thanks.
Yeah. Well, hey, and so before you ended up coming to WWF, that was in 2022, I believe. Tell us about some of your work experience and what you've done.
Sure. Well, after the PhD, I did a couple different postdoctoral research positions. I spent a year working still at Scripps with one of my committee members, George Sugihara, and he, we were working on a project with people at the University of New Hampshire in Woods Hole, and I got to spend a summer at the Woods Hole National Marine Fisheries Service office there working with Mike Fogarty, who's a NOAA scientist, working fisheries. And so that was great. I mean, Woods Hole is just such a wonderful place to spend a summer. And then I worked as a postdoc for a year at the University of Kansas. So back to my roots, but I was working with Professor Ford Ballantyne on some predator prey models. And then eventually I ended up at the College of William and Mary in Virginia, and the Virginia Institute of Marine Science is affiliated there. So I was teaching classes and working as a visiting scientist at VIMS, and then on the in the biology department at William and Mary. So that was kind of my introduction to the Chesapeake Bay and the really great work that those scientists are doing to understand groundfish fisheries and what's happening here on the east coast of the U.S.
Wow, you've been all around. I was at VIMS just recently. I work for a company that has an underwater glider, and we did a little like at-sea test with it. It did fantastic, and I really like the scientists there. And because I live on the Chesapeake Bay, I admire what they do. And I'm so wonderful to have you be so well-rounded with experience in different oceans and really understanding in different fisheries. Like the tuna, as you mentioned, sardine, anchovy, and now you have the bay. And really neat to see where you've been. What led you to say and learn about this opportunity at WWF?
I pivoted a little bit in my career away from being just a purely biology ecology specialist. I mean, honestly, the interest in the field of conflict over fisheries and illegal fishing started during my PhD at Scripps. I was researching tuna fisheries global. You know, when you start to write these things and you sit down and you spend a couple of months writing 300 pages about tuna that a few people will read, you end up doing a lot of wide reading to figure, you know, to kind of get your facts straight. And I started reading work about tuna fish and tuna fisheries in West Africa. Oh. And in West Africa, in particular, the Gulf of Guinea. And so offshore, there are some really productive fishing grounds there. And those stocks, a lot of them were being leased, is one word to use. They were being leased. The access to fish stocks within the national boundaries of a lot of West African nations had been sold to foreign fishing fleets. And, you know, back in 2008, 2009, that included the French, the Spanish, a lot of EU flagged fleets that would come down from the EU and fish there, as well as a growing presence of China and Taiwan in those waters. And so West African nations would have their boats are very small, and it's more difficult for them to go further out from shore. So they would sell access to the fish that were a lot further offshore that a lot of their fishers couldn't catch, simply because it was too dangerous to go out there in their small boats, and a lot of other reasons. So they would lease the access rights to foreign fishing boats. The problem with that was those boats were coming closer and closer to shore. They were interacting with the small scale fishing boats. And a lot of people were calling this just pure theft, that this was theft of the fishing resources that belonged to West African nations. And we were starting to see impacts on poverty, on food security, and simply just issues of just access to these resources. And so there was the beginnings of conflict and rumblings about inequitable access to marine resources and the fair division of access to those resources. So that was something I started reading about. And then I started working in Lake Victoria. And I'll just say, I was so pleased at the beginning to hear that this podcast is also dedicated to Great Lakes research, because I think we sometimes forget to talk about the freshwater systems.
Right, right. What got you to Lake Victoria?
My husband, actually. So he's a political scientist, and he was doing research on the role of coffee and coffee trade from Uganda and some other work. And he had a trip there, and I was in the throes of writing my dissertation, and I thought, well, I can go too. So I went with him, and while we were there, we managed to organize a meeting with the National Fisheries Resources Research Institute based in Jinja, Uganda, and talked to them about the work that they were doing, and a partnership grew out of that. And so I worked with scientists in Uganda and Kenya and Tanzania, and we put together some research cruises on the lake and some surveys of fishing communities. And the goal was to understand the role of aquaculture, and then how wild capture fisheries in Lake Victoria would potentially interact with some of the aquaculture that was happening in the lake as well.
Wow, wow. You really are engineered for this job, being your globe-trotting experience as well as your fisheries science experience. Wow, that's so interesting. Well, okay, I think if you don't mind, unless there's anything else to share about your background, should we move into the Ocean Futures Initiative?
Yeah, let's do it. Well, the last thing I'll mention is that work kind of springboarded me into what I did for the 8 years before I came to WWF, which is working at One Earth Future Foundation, which is a peace building foundation based near Denver, Colorado. And that really got me involved in these issues of illegal fishing on the high seas and government policy responses to it and what it means for the global community. So that work was really seminal. And I'm really proud of the team that remains there at the program Secure Fisheries, as they're working really closely with local communities, but as well as the federal government of Somalia and the government in Somaliland on promoting healthy responses to illegal fishing around the Horn of Africa.
That's just terrific. Wow. So you really do have the chops for this project. And so to introduce it, Sarah, so we have a common friend, Johan Berganis, and I met him when I was at NOAA, and I was working as part of my blue economy promotion, number of efforts to counter illegal fishing, working with the U.S. Coast Guard, who was very actively engaged. At one point, I during COVID, we actually still went to the Coast Guard headquarters, and I sat at a table during a release of the Coast Guard's illegal fishing strategic outlook. And I sat with the Commandant and the Southcom commander, Admiral Craig Faller, a good friend of mine, and Ben Purser, who is a Deputy Assistant Secretary of the State Department. And we all basically talked about illegal fishing and how important it was, a national security issue. About the first time that leaders at our level have said that. And this was in 2020, I believe. And since then, that position's only been reinforced and amplified. So I have that as my background. And then Johan, who works with you at WWF now, spoken with me, and he was thinking, what is the big issue, a big issue that we can all work together to address? And then he wrote this great op-ed called The Other Global Food Crisis. Could you summarize it for us, Sarah?
Yeah, I think the real take-home point of that op-ed that was in Foreign Policy is that we are not paying attention to the importance of blue foods in contributing to food security and the risk therein to this source of food security if we don't pay closer attention to climate change. So blue foods can very broadly be defined as food derived from aquatic sources. So that's freshwater, that's ocean food sources, but it's also aquaculture or wild capture. And so a lot of people just think of fish or seafood, but it's not just fish. It also includes seaweed and foodstuffs derived from aquatic resources. So, you know, a couple good examples of this are that USAID has a really important model that's called the Famine Early Warning System Model, or FUSENET. And they use that to help direct their resources and their attention and make strategic plans about where they need to invest to, first of all, prevent, but second of all, respond to humanitarian crises over famine. So acute sources of food insecurity and famine. And You know, I think the easiest thing to think about is where are droughts going to cause agricultural collapses? And so the Horn of Africa is a good example of that, right? But in the model that they use to predict where food security crises and famines are going to happen, there's not a treatment of seafood or blue foods separate from other forms. And so, for example, you could imagine that the map of the world and the risk to the world looks different if you focus on terrestrial versus ocean-based, or I should say aquatic-based foodstuffs. And so that's just one example of how, for the most part, attention to seafood and other blue foods oftentimes takes a backseat to other types of food security. And that's not really a criticism. I think most of the food that we eat is globally in particular is derived from terrestrial agriculture, you know, rice and corn and other types of beef and poultry, you know, that's really makes up the majority of it. But what Johan wanted to highlight in that op-ed was that there are still 3 billion people in the world who get their number one source of animal protein from blue foods. And in coastal communities in particular, which host a huge proportion of the world's population, fisheries and fish and blue foods are even more important and a really important vital source of micronutrients that support childhood brain development and maternal health and those sorts of things. So the point of that op-ed was to draw attention to the importance of blue foods and see if we can't raise its profile.
It was great. It was a great piece. And it really appealed to me, Sarah, because, and thank you for summarizing it. Here I am, a naval officer of 32 years. I have my job has been maritime security, and this is a really critical component of that. And an argument has been made in various places about the importance of maritime security and global security at large being probably having a really significant role. And so knowing that there was this component that I hadn't really paid much attention to, I thought it was terrific. And so this is. Now, thus, and you're, so I think the Ocean Futures Initiative, I believe the best, I guess, introduction, case study, case in point, was your paper about the issue in the South China Sea titled Global Climate El Nino and Militarized Fisheries Disputes in the East and South China Sea. And that caught my attention because of my background. And right now, the Navy's top competitor is China, and that is basically the region where that conflict is seeing some of its most intense activity. And so share with our listeners a bit about that paper. I mean, really, it's hard to ask you to summarize it, but because it's just so worthy of reading in its entirety. But what are the takeaways that we can draw from that?
Thanks for those kind words. You know, it was an academic paper probably behind a paywall. So you're right. I don't think too many people will get a chance to read it. But what the gist of the paper is looking at El Nino events, which are normal climate anomalies, right? El Nino is something that's happened long before humans started putting fossil fuels into the atmosphere and causing global climate change. But El Ninos are potentially going to become more common. And it's a warming of the waters in the Pacific Ocean that then has spillover effects for the entire globe. And that's because the atmosphere and the ocean are really tightly connected from a physical standpoint. And so changes in the ocean and sea surface temperature impact rainfall all the way over in Africa. So changes in sea surface temperature in the middle of the Pacific, particularly off the west coast of South America, there's a domino effect and it affects rainfall patterns everywhere. So people have probably heard this year that we're in El Nino conditions. Sometime this summer, I think it was, NOAA made the announcement that the data had finally shown that, yep, and we knew it was coming, that there's an El Nino. So these anomalous conditions have a pretty big impact on fish, and in particular, small pelagic fish like sardines and anchovies that we talked about before, and where those fish are located and how abundant they are. And so we had a hypothesis that was under these climate anomalies, we might expect a reshuffling of the world's fishing fleets as they chase fish into new waters. So sometimes the fish don't reproduce as well, but other times they move. And so when the world's fishing fleet starts to move and follow the fish in ways that are not normal, or I should say different from normal, they start to enter into new territories. Maybe the vessel on which they operate isn't flagged or allowed to operate in certain waters, or maybe it just means that the conditions are getting more crowded on the ocean because people are being lumped together under different sea surface temperature conditions. So our hypothesis was that we would see a relationship. And so it's a statistical model, which means that we have good statistical power. And what we can say is that conflict, international conflicts between two countries that were militarized, so that there was some sort of armed conflict involving at least one military, were three times more likely under El Nino conditions. And that's kind of the scientific interpretation. But when I think about what that means for us, it means that under climate anomalies, which are expected to be more prevalent under systemic climate change over the coming century, the world's oceans are going to get shaken up in ways that we need to start to understand. Because if we can understand it, we can respond before these shakeups happen. And so the global fishing fleet's chasing fish, and the fish are chasing sea surface temperatures that they like. And so that's what we learned. And, it's interesting how these scientific papers go through review, anonymous review. We actually did the research for the entire world, and we found that relationship for the whole world. But the reviewers were really interested in the specifics of the South and East China Sea. So that's kind of what we focused on in the article. And that's probably because of what you alluded to, which is this is an area of high geopolitical stakes. The area has been militarized already, not only because of fisheries, but for other reasons, and there are a lot of conflicts already ongoing. So the article focuses on that area of the world, but that relationship held up for the rest of the world as well.
Interesting. That three factor of threefold number is really significant. And that's why I love this paper of yours, because something I've advocated for in my op-eds and other areas is a lot of people will claim, they'll sort of latch onto this climate alarmism and have it, and it's very vague and unspecific. And I don't think that serves a purpose very well, because it often antagonizes people and polarizes the discussion between those who think there's a little bit of those who aren't alarmist, basically. And I think when we just have more disciplined conversations about the impacts of climate change, about what's really occurring, like your paper about, then especially with regard to security, I've seen a lot of people talk about climate exacerbating security challenges. Well, really, let's be specific about where those are and how much. And I think that's more productive and useful. And your paper does that perfectly. And that's why now, following with this Ocean Futures platform that you developed, you're the architect and brains behind the operation. Tell us about this now, and how this went about, and how have you been developing it, what it entails. The floor is yours. I think it's just so when we have this topic of climate security, I cannot think of a better example about how to address that head on. So over to you, Sarah.
Well, thank you. So, in some ways, Oceans Futures is an online platform for people to explore data around the issue. But I would say, on the other hand, we also see this as a way of really driving attention to the issues that we've been talking about, the potential for blue foods to play a bigger role in the food security conversation, and the importance of bringing people together to talk about ways to prevent conflict and have, peaceful resolution to some of the conflicts that we can see coming a mile away. And what does that mean for our multilateral institutions? And what does that, so our theory of change is really that raising the issue of the problem of conflict over fisheries as a global issue, and one that's getting worse under climate change, can help direct that conversation and bring together communities that do work together and have worked together, but maybe give us even more urgency, more resources. So I'm talking about the conservation community, who really works globally with communities around the world who are engaged every single day on safety at sea and, sustainable fisheries management, and being part of a thriving fisheries sector, and seeing all of that be put at risk under climate change and illegal fishing. But also the seafood industry, who has a really important role to play in where fish are sourced, how they're sourced, trying to make sure that they're bringing to market a product that is free of conflict and free of illegal fishing and illegality, and really making sure consumers know what they're eating and that sort of thing. But it's also a collaboration with the field from which you come, right? Our security agencies, our law enforcement agencies, and making sure that the laws that we pass and the policies that we put on the books to promote sustainable fisheries don't just create paper parks, don't just create things that aren't enforced, right? Yeah, that was the term that I learned in the Turks and Caicos in 97 was a paper park, a park in name only.
That's right, that's right.
Yeah, and I think that with the world focused on 30 by, well, I should say, a small bubble of the world focused on 30 by 30, which is the goal of protecting 30% of the world's wild spaces on both land and sea by the year 2030, we really have to make sure that we're not just drawing lines that we can't actually enforce. And so thinking, so anyway, I'm getting off topic, but the goal
I'm with
is
you
to,
on that one. We can talk about that later. Sure.
But so our theory of change is that raising these issues will help contribute to this much larger conversation about the importance of prioritizing conservation as a means of creating more peaceful oceans. Right. So what we've done over the past year is, We had some really in-depth conversations with members of the U.S. Coast Guard, U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, people in Congress, but also conservation groups. We're partnering with the Environmental Defense Fund on this, for example, members of industry, groups that work, you know, directly with Congress, and then scientists. Lots and lots of conversations and data sharing and analysis done by scientists at the University of British Columbia and elsewhere, who really are experts on this issue. And what we did was bring all of that together and create an analysis of what we think is going to happen in the future, not too far in the future, just 2030 right now, and where we think hotspots of illegal fishing and conflict over fisheries will emerge. And that analysis is driven by climate models that show how sea surface temperature and other dynamics in the oceans, such as productivity and upwelling, how that will change under emission scenarios of greater and less fossil fuel emissions. What that means for the fish populations in the ocean that will respond to changing climate, but also changing predator and prey situations. So fish will follow their food and that food will change as well under climate. And then bringing to bear on that the data that we know describe the causes of fisheries conflict. So, for example, data that shows us where foreign fishing fleets are operating inside national waters, sometimes perfectly legally. In fact, most of the data we have is about legal fishing. But we know that foreign fishing vessels are one of the biggest causes of conflict. So where is the foreign fishing fleet? Where do we expect them to go? How important is seafood to a given nation or coastal community for supporting food security? You know, some socioeconomic factors. And we put these variables together and we did what we call a hotspot analysis to identify the top 20 hotspots of conflict in the future.
And so tell me about the data, how many data types or sources did you have to, do you mine now, does this platform mine to produce this hotspot analysis?
I want to say, you know, I've never counted, but I want to say nine. So we're looking at, foreign fishing effort, that's one thing. And we get those data from Global Fishing Watch. We're looking at a measure of the sustainability of fish stocks, and we get that data from the Ocean Health Index, which shows the trend in catch. Is catch going up or is catch going down? Which is a proxy for kind of sustainability status. Our seafood dependency data, so how much seafood do people eat in a given country? It varies widely from 2% to 70%.
Oh, so tell me about that. What country is 2% and what country is 70%?
Somalia, I think, was 2 or 3%, and the 70% was Cambodia. So that's all fish-derived products. So especially with Cambodia, a lot of that might be freshwater fish from the Mekong Delta. But so we're looking at that. Those data come from the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. We also know that one of the major causes of conflict, and this is going to sound kind of tautological, especially from your experience, Tim, but is borders. Borders cause conflict, right? And so we looked at places where there are actual disputes over international maritime borders. So maybe those disputes have been lodged with the United Nations and they're in front of the international courts for adjudication. Other times they're just disputed claims that may or may not be formally legally recognized. So we looked at areas where there were disputed borders. Then we also looked at how much of a location was considered a marine protected area or a marine park or some form of conservation and management that involved borders.
Now,
so a lot of times,
is the Galapagos an example of that?
It is, yeah. The Galapagos is an example of a protected area within the larger Ecuador exclusive economic zone.
So, and maybe just to introduce a little bit of an example. Besides the fact that I'm going there in a week and I cannot wait to go diving with my wife there for 10 days, but
I'm jealous.
I know. Sorry, I'll make sure I share pictures with you. But but what happened is when I made that release downtown at the Coast Guard headquarters in 2020 of the Coast Guard's IEU Outlook, the big news at the time was that the Chinese Distant Water Fleet was making incursions into that MPA. And so that is one example for that, knowing that that was an MPA, that is a big problem for Ecuador, and therefore up the likelihood. And I mean, the U.S. Coast Guard was getting involved. So that is that one example of the likelihood kind of upticking because of that variable.
Yeah, yes, that is absolutely well said. I mean, it's not just those borders there. And, you know, are they here? Or are they there? Which side are they on? Are they potentially fishing perfectly legally? But it increases the level of tension over the issue. And it increases public attention, media attention, high level political attention. And so there was that incident that you just mentioned, but also the squid fleet, the international squid fleet that operates around the Galapagos are catching a lot of fish. They're catching a lot of squid, but they're also catching a lot of sharks. So there's kind of that direct relationship or that direct pathway to conflict that you nicely elucidated. And there's also the indirect pathway to conflict, which is changes in the availability of fish and what that means for the people left behind. That might not be the best way to describe it, but let me expand on what I mean. The international global fishing fleet, huge vessels, sometimes they have motherships with massive processing plants on board and access to ice and blast freezers. That means they can be out at sea for a long time. They follow the fish. They move where the fish or the squid or what have you. They follow the fish. But domestic vessels oftentimes don't leave their own waters for a variety of reasons. They're smaller, they need to refuel more often, they may not have the cold storage capability of keeping fish blast frozen, flash frozen, so that the fish stays good for a long time. And frankly, the smaller your boat is, the more you get rocked around out at sea when conditions get wavy. And so they don't go as far from home. And so they also may not have permission to cross international borders and fish in other waters. And so there are a lot of reasons why the domestic fleet is contained to their own waters. And if the fisheries there get depleted, either by their own fishing or by the combination of foreign fishing vessels in the region, because we know that fish and squid don't respect borders, right? They'll cross from one area to another area. The global fishing fleet can follow those fish, but the small scale fishers can't a lot of times.
Interesting. I want to ask you now, what do you have any databases that are that it represent the changes in climate or in the ecosystem or habitat?
The climate, yes. We don't. So we have proxies for the habitat, and that would be kind of proxied by catch trend here.
Oh, okay.
But what we don't have in the model yet is, say, independent, and when I say independent, I mean separate from the fish populations themselves or the fish stocks, right? We don't have independent estimates of ecosystem change right now. But so, Tim, you know, we're going to be launching this on November 18th, and your listeners can can find out then kind of what our ultimate conclusions and what the data are saying. But that's not the end of this project. It's really just the beginning. So we have plans over the next 3 years to expand what we're doing, the types of data that we interrogate, the partners that we're working with and the solutions that we want to advocate for. And so, you know, we're really trying to brainstorm here and be creative about the best ways to operationalize this challenge and what does it mean. So, you know, I'll put a question back to you, which is, you know, what makes you ask that question and what is it that you're thinking of in terms of ecosystem health.
Right, right. Well, this is interesting. I still follow NOAA Fisheries, and they have a global scope. They're working with partner nations in the Pacific, for example, as well as all our domestic in the U.S. EEZ fisheries and fish stocks. And just recently, a NOAA scientist from NOAA's Alaska Fishery Science Center, Corey Zawalski, was quoted in CNN for a paper he published that looked at the causes of this billion crab decline in the snow crab fishery of Alaska, basically just a disappearance over a season or two. I don't remember the exact length, but it was very notable. And ultimately, the warming in the region chased out caused the food source to migrate. And I've been following the warming Arctic closely and the migration of fish stocks. So that's what kind of what I was wondering is that's a big trend. It's occurring. It's in the Arctic, which is another zone of competition right now, including China and Russia and the U.S. And that's all. I was just kind of curious how, like, as we look to the hotspots you're going to announce November 18th, just understanding how the analysis is done.
Yeah. No. Thanks for that elaboration. I mean, the mystery, not so mystery, of the disappearing crabs has been really, really interesting. And I know that WWF and our teams up in Alaska have paid a lot of attention to it because it did catch us by surprise. And by us, I mean the scientific community. That's one of the problems with, one of the challenges with trying to be predictive is sometimes you're wrong, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think it's important to, a good friend of mine who works in this field of maritime security, Dr. Curtis Bell, who's at the College of Naval Warfare, he always says to me, "Sarah, call your shot," you know, and which is a pool reference, a reference to pool. But he's like, you got to call your shot. That's really the best test of whether or not your hypothesis is accurate or your data and your model are accurate is how good are you at predicting the future? And one of the great things about these climate models is that they make predictions based on different scenarios all the way out to 2100. I'm not comfortable with what we're trying to do, you know, predicting out to 2100. I think the world's going to change underneath our feet. But I do like thinking about what's going to happen short term in the future. And I think one of the challenges as a scientist is figuring out what are the most important factors to pay attention to. What are the ones that are highly correlated with each other? So let's say, variable A and variable B track each other. You don't need to have both of them in the model. You can just pick one and say, well, B is going to track A, so let's just include A in the model. But not leaving out the really important things. That's one of the big challenges is what are the important things to capture? And that's where some basic statistics come in and trying to set that aside. But at the same time, you know, most of the people whom I've shown the methods and the early results, that's been their biggest feedback is what are some other variables that you can include to cover these things a little bit better. So that's what we're looking for as soon as this thing launches is running at the next version and just continuing to make it better.
I love that continuous improvement and not just sort of firing and forgetting. I love that you're doing this. And I want to highlight something important. Having worked with side by side in the intelligence community and naval intelligence, in my area of meteorology and oceanography, predictive capability is at our core. It's what weather forecasting is all about. And over the last several decades, our improvements in weather forecasting have been nothing short of phenomenal, where we couldn't predict 20 years ago more than 3 days out with that skill, and now we can do it to nearly 10 for some weather scenarios. And look at hurricane predictions. My gosh, we can a week out get a pretty good handle, not on every storm, but some we've had very good handle on where even a hurricane might make landfall in a week. That's remarkable. The number of lives saved is just can't be counted. And that's where we need to be going with these other big issues and approach that level of skill. And it's harder with people, with fish, with biology, but we should be striving for that. And so I love that your professor friend, Curtis Bell, is his name?
Mm-hmm, yep.
I like that. Call the shot. Make the call. This is what we should be striving for. And we know we'll get better when we course correct and learn and assess. Okay, how do we do here? All right, we missed that. Let's improve in this area. So I just think it's just the whole process and the goal is so admirable and important. And going back to this issue, and I'm going to throw something out there that might you know, might not be ready for. But so we're seeing the world in a pretty intense state right now. We have a war in Ukraine, and we are involved. The United States is involved. We have the Israeli-Hamas war, and the U.S. is involved supporting Israel. And now we have a potential large conflict with China on the horizon. And I want you to just think out loud here. So these are big drivers that are, I would say, resource-generated conflicts or components are a part of these. Fish may or may not be a factor in any one of them or can. In fact, with the Russian one, it was interesting. I wrote an op-ed last year about including seafood in the sanctions to squeeze Putin. And that has been made a partial contribution to that effort. It hasn't made a big difference yet. I think we could do more. But how do you see this platform factoring into some of these larger scale issues? What would you say?
Well, I guess I would say, you know, the platform is and the lessons learned for it. It's more strategic than tactical.
Right.
Right. So I think that that's one of the. The time scale is one thing. You know, we're making some predictions out to 2030, and talking to the scientists at the University of British Columbia who run this model, we really start to see differences, so divergences in the model predictions in about 2030, 2040. So it's not useful for us to try to predict tomorrow or even 2024. But once you start getting out about 5, 10, even 15 years, the model starts to kind of settle down a little bit and be a little bit better. So what I think is that information is probably not useful from a tactical perspective, but thinking strategically about where the partnerships need to be put in place.
There you go.
Knowing where things are going. To me, that's the big deal. I mean, the way I look at it is, you know, we're going to have these 20 hotspots, but what about hotspot 21, right? What do they not rise in the priority list of things that we need to do? Of course it does, right? Our goal is to really talk about the issues and the causes of conflict, but also highlighting what other countries are doing as a means of sharing solutions. So one of the things we're going to do in version two, I should say phase two, after our launch next month is we're building a brand new data set. And we're working with people at Oregon State University and Cornell and Exeter University and the Peterson Institute for International Economics. And we have a really highly refined data set on small scale fisheries conflicts, many of which are nonviolent, many of which happen within communities, between communities. That data set, we started building a methodology for collecting those data a few years ago, and we have data for 30 years, but only in 6 different countries. And those countries all happen to be together. They're in the Horn of Africa and East Africa. And what we learned from that really deep dive, specific low-level conflict data is what caused conflict and where conflict escalates, but more importantly, where it doesn't escalate. And so one of our focuses after we launch next month is to continue building that data set for the rest of the world. And what we can do is understand globally what causes conflicts to rise to the level of violent conflict, as well as conflict that involves militaries or armed conflict. And then compare and contrast around the world and say, well, this country, for some reason, their conflicts don't escalate. What are they doing? Or this region, right? What are these partners in this region doing? Are they sharing information about illegal fishing? Do they have strong histories of multilateral resource management? You know, like the U.S. and the U.S. and Canada has a long relationship around co-managing fisheries that move between the U.S. and Canada. And so what are the things that we see in common in these countries, and what are the lessons that we can learn and apply them other places? And more importantly, what can we do from a conservation standpoint to protect resources so that we don't get to this point in the first place? So, you know, regardless of where those 20 hotspots are going to be, the solutions to these challenges are solutions that we should be doing anyway, right? We should be enforcing our borders around marine parks and protecting the fish stocks inside of them so that they can reproduce and spill over into the areas where fishing takes place. We should be focused on reducing illegality in the seafood supply chain and addressing issues of human rights abuse and labor abuses in the seafood industry. We should be addressing posturing by other countries and geopolitical tensions over access to fisheries resources and how the ocean is a place of peace and security, right? All of those issues need to be addressed regardless of what we learn from this. We're just trying, so those solutions are things that we just really find important in terms of driving resources and attention.
Absolutely. I love this, that we're taking such a rigorous approach to these important security issues. And I think just a final question for you is, you have a pretty impressive advisory board. And so I just want to talk a little bit about, you don't necessarily have to mention names unless you want to, but just who you brought on board, for what reason, and how you think they can help you move forward and actually make sure that this platform is used for productive and positive policy decisions.
Absolutely. I'm happy to talk about my advisory board. So we started, one of our goals in version one was to really make the argument around geopolitics of nature and the national security and illegal fishing role. And so our advisory board right now reflects that priority and reflects our interest in understanding what those communities can do. And so, you know, Tim, you're on our advisory board.
That's right,
and,
gladly.
And we reached out to you because of your experience being the oceanographer for the Navy, your role at NOAA as well. And it had nothing to do with your background at Scripps, I promise.
Ah, thank you. It's okay.
And so we've got you on there. And we have a couple other representatives of the U.S. military, including Scott Clendenin from the U.S. Coast Guard, and the former commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, Paul Zakunt.
So my friend, yes.
Yeah, and we're getting the perspective of, what is it really like out there on the water, right? You know, what does it mean to enforce our laws? The Coast Guard has law enforcement abilities. And what does it mean to encounter vessels that are aggressively illegally fishing, and what can we do to support our nation's and other nations' response to this particular issue? But we also think it's really important to think about the role of climate and climate security. And so we've got Sherry Goodman, who is really one of the founders of that field of inquiry for the U.S. federal government, and thinking about how climate change really impacts security considerations very broadly, and bringing that to the government to act. And Ellen Lapson with the intelligence community, and what kind of data do we really need to understand this issue? How do we drive this issue in ways that make sense to the practitioners and people in the field who are trying to understand this from a strategic and tactical perspective? And then we've got Josh Busby, who's a professor at the University of Texas, who has been a leader in not only the methods that I'm using, hotspot analysis, but thinking through how we talk about issues of climate change and security, and making sure that the solutions that we put in place are ones that prevent the military from having to deal with it, right? We don't want this to escalate. We're trying to find solutions that prevent these conflicts from escalating. And so we're relying on the methods and the data and the research that Josh has done in this space around the world, and adopting some of those and adapting them for oceans issues. And then finally, Tegan Blaine, another one of our colleagues from Scripps Institution of Oceanography, who works at the U.S. Institute for Peace on issues of climate security, for the U.S. Institute for Peace, and in particular, what climate change risks are looking like as climate change unfolds on the African continent. So that's our advisory board, and you and the other members have just been so generous with your time and your feedback on ways that we can have impact with the research that we're doing, and who we need to be talking to, and the things we need to be thinking about to put in place the proper suggestions for ways forward.
Well, it's a great team. I'm honored to be a part of it. And I love that I still have an opportunity to contribute, even though I'm not in the government. Actually, it's even a little more liberating. So thank you for the opportunity there, Sarah. And so here we are, we're chatting about the World Wildlife Fund's Ocean Futures Platform, and led by you, Sarah, Dr. Sarah Glasser, the Senior Director for this initiative. Do you want to share, lastly, with our audience, any final thoughts before we close on the platform, on its purpose, and what you hope to see in the next steps?
Sure. I mean, I think what I'd love to end with is just to get the audience thinking about some of these issues and what it means for their choices on a day-to-day basis. And I think I assume that the audience that engages with your podcast are already thinking about these issues, because otherwise, why would they be listening to the podcast in the first place? But I think that bringing these issues home to the choices that we make and the choices that are even available to us as people who live on this planet, as consumers either of seafood or of other forms of blue food or of resources that come from the ocean, and what it means to really source things from the ocean. So there was some really important reporting about 2 weeks ago from a journalist named Ian Urbina about forced labor in seafood processing plants and just the prevalence of human rights abuses and slavery on seafood processing vessels and fishing vessels around the world. And so getting people to think about the interconnection of all of the things that we do on the earth and how, you know, what we put on our plate is connected to the health of ecosystems in places a lot of us never get to go visit. That's what I'd like to leave our listeners with.
That's terrific. Thank you so much, Sarah. This has just been a wonderful discussion, and it's great now that we're working together already to be able to have reinforced that just a bit further. And so thank you for joining us. It's just been a pleasure.
My pleasure, Tim. It was really fun talking to you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Looking forward to more work together. And thank you to our listeners for joining us on this last leg of our journey, or latest leg of our journey, in the American Blue Economy podcast. So in this episode, we've looked at the World Wildlife Fund's Ocean Futures platform, a very important element in advancing the American blue economy, as well as a larger sustainable global blue economy. Please join us for our next episode in November. This is your host, Admiral Tim Gallaudet, CEO of Ocean STL Consulting. Thank you for joining us, shipmates. I look forward to getting underway with you next time.